Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
You're listening to Back in the USSR. It's been a difficult last few weeks, comrades and friends. Keeping my morale up has been very hard. I, of course, am Siegfried. But I'm finally ready to do this long-planned episode on International Women's Day 2021, even if it's a little late. This past year has been absolutely crucial in the struggle for women's rights all over the world. I mean, the pandemic has affected women particularly harshly and has exacerbated the inequalities and structural oppression that they face. Women are the majority of essential and frontline workers. Women continue to bear a disproportionate share of household labor and child rearing, in addition to their work outside the home. And women have been facing an additional epidemic of femicide and patriarchal violence that has surged all over the world alongside COVID-19. One day after International Women's Day, on March 9th, 2021, the World Health Organization released a report based on the largest study ever conducted on violence against women. And they released it in partnership with the UN. The report covered the period between the year 2000 and 2018 and concluded that violence against women remains devastatingly pervasive. That's their words, not mine. Devastatingly pervasive across the globe, with one in every three women in the world facing some form of physical or sexual violence. One in three. More specifically, the report found that one out of every four young women, I mean, this is women aged between 15 and 24 years, one in every four young women has experienced violence at the hands of an intimate partner by their mid-20s. So by their mid-20s, they have already experienced violence at the hands of an intimate partner. Not a stranger, an intimate partner. And violence by an intimate partner is the most prevalent form of violence against women by far, everywhere in the world. According to the study, in 90% of reported cases, look at the numbers here. We were talking 641 million out of 736 million cases. We're talking hundreds of millions, when we're looking at the cases collected in the study, hundreds of millions. 641 million out of 736 million. 90%. The perpetrator was either the husband or a partner. I mean, these are shocking numbers. But the report added that because violence against women is so underreported due to social stigma and various structural reasons, the real number is much higher. The real number is much higher than that. And of course, this is, the most, comprehensive survey of violence against women ever. And even it can't really get at the real numbers. And while the highest levels of patriarchal violence were found to be in South Asia, WHO Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, made the point that, quote, violence against women is endemic in every country and culture, causing harm to millions of women and their families, end quote. And while the WHO report, which once again was made in partnership with the UN, did not include data collected during the COVID pandemic, it did emphasize that violence against women has increased since the pandemic began. The UN woman executive director, Phumzile Mlambo Nakuga, even said that COVID had triggered a, quote, shadow pandemic of increasing violence against women and girls. The lockdowns and quarantines in particular rendering them more vulnerable to intimate partner violence. And remember that 90% of violence against women reported in that study is from an intimate partner. I mean, this is the situation that we're facing today. And a lot of this is normalized violence, culturally normalized violence in the family. But women are fighting back. Women across the entire world are fighting back bravely in the midst of a pandemic against the patriarchal systems imposed on them and are refusing to be silent. Fighting for a world where their rights, their equality, their dignity are non-negotiable. Last year, I talked about the massive demonstrations that took place on International Women's Day 2020, where 2 million women, marched in downtown Santiago, the capital city of Chile, defying the neoliberal regime of Sebastián Piñera and a police force that was and still is notorious for its brutal assaults and sexual crimes. All over Latin America and around the world, millions of women marched against growing inequality, the rising rate of femicide, anti-women violence, as well as reactionary laws against abortion in multiple countries. That was last year. International Women's Day 2021 was no different. You know, despite the pandemic and the lockdowns, in addition to police repression, millions of women still came out to march. From Argentina to Mexico, millions of women marched across Latin America to demand equality in the most unequal region in the world, and to proclaim that they refuse to continue being marginalized, discriminated against, excluded, and murdered. In Buenos Aires, right, starting with the capital of Argentina, in Buenos Aires, the Not One Woman Less movement, you know, this big women's movement that exists in Argentina, marched alongside trade unions and social organizations to demand equal rights for women in the workplace, respect for trans rights in the workplace, and to demand the approval of the emergency law on gender violence. And that last point is pretty crucial, because in the course of the first 67 days of 2021, the first 67 days, 65 women were murdered in Argentina for the simple fact of being a woman. So basically one per day. You know, like this is the rate of femicides we're talking about in Argentina. In Brazil, you know, thousands of women took to the streets of major cities to demand the impeachment of Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right president of Brazil, who has presided over a horrific escalation in femicides and violence against women and the LGBTQ community. You know, like, I mean, women's organizations, they also condemn the government's callous mismanagement of the pandemic and its pro-business policies that have resulted in rising hunger, poverty, and unemployment, which also disproportionately impacts women. You know, all these things are tied together. And that's the case, like, across the region and around the world. I mean, women are coming out with an understanding that capitalism and femicide and violence against women, these things are connected, you know. And especially, you know, we're talking a case like Brazil, where basically you have a fascist government in power. And going back to Chile, you know, I mentioned last year, 2 million women came out into the streets in Santiago on International Women's Day. This year, 500,000 came out, which is still like incredible numbers given that, this is in the middle of a pandemic. 500,000 women came out into the streets of Santiago to the iconic Dignity Plaza, once again in opposition to Sebastián Piñera's right-wing neoliberal government and its policies, which are disproportionately impacting and abusing women. And these women, they came up 500,000. They faced tear gas, water cannon, but they still stood strong and ultimately forced the police to retreat. And across the country, millions of Chilean women took part in a national strike calling for gender parity in all realms, as well as non-sexist education and the right to free, legal, and safe abortion, which once again is a common theme around the whole region. I mean, thousands of women in the Dominican Republic demanded reproductive rights on International Women's Day, as well as that femicide and other forms of anti-women violence be included as punishable offenses in the country's penal code, which they currently are not, which is immensely disturbing. In El Salvador, thousands of women gathered in the capital to call for the legalization of abortion. Journalists and reporters also joined this march to demand the right to cover and report on gender-based violence, which they're not allowed to do under the country's reactionary laws. They're not allowed to even report on gender-based violence. You know, if they do that, they're going to get in trouble. They're going to be penalized under the law. That's how bad things are there, right? And why people are fighting back and why, like, women are marching. In Honduras, one of three Latin American countries, along with El Salvador and the Dominican Republic, where abortion is totally banned under all circumstances. In Honduras, women marched against a wave of femicides that has claimed over 50 lives since the beginning of the year. You know, I mean, this is a country, like, I think it's got less than 8 million people. But the legacy of Bertha Cáceres and other land defenders and, like, people who have fought women who fight for the rights of women. And, you know, against a capitalist system that is destroying the land as well as women's bodies. These women will not be silent. You know, they're still fighting back, even against, you know, all odds, all the pressures brought against them by the U.S. puppet regime there, which basically keeps itself in power by corruption and violence. Women are fighting back there too. And in Mexico, a country with one of the highest rates of femicide in the world, tens of thousands of women marched in the capital, Mexico City, and turned the metal fence surrounding the National Palace into a wall of memory, covering it with the names and faces of thousands of women killed in recent years. And similar marches were held in Guatemala, Ecuador, and Colombia. But it wasn't only in Latin America where mass mobilization took place on International Women's Day. Of course, it happened all across the world. And, I mean, in all across Europe, women came out in droves to protest the rise in femicide, misogyny, and conservative far-right laws oppressing them. You know, in Poland in particular, thousands of women demonstrated across the country under the leadership of the National Women's Strike, you know, which is a movement that's been going on for some time now, protesting against the blatant misogyny of the right-wing government and its recent ban on abortions, you know, which took place last year. And, like, you know, thousands upon thousands of women have been getting radicalized and getting into the streets since that ban on abortions was passed. You know, because this, of course, cuts to the heart of, you know, their struggle, the heart of their struggle for their rights. I mean, this is a country where upwards of 500 women die every year as a result of domestic violence, and where 94% of those who suffer rape or molestation do not report it to the authorities, especially like a taboo subject, as it is in many parts of the world. But, women are fighting to change that. You know, thousands of women are fighting to change that. They're not taking this anymore. And not that they ever did. I mean, in France, women's organizations and trade unions organized 150 mobilizations across the country, protesting the rise in violence against women that has spun out of control since the pandemic began. This is France, you know. This is Western Europe. You know, like very, very wealthy country and stuff like that. And even there, right? Like you got like a major spike in violence against women since the pandemic began. And the organization Grève Féministe, you know, also pointed out that, quote, women, increasingly migrant women, make up the majority of those in care, health, education, and cleaning jobs. They are underpaid and get little or no recognition. Despite the beautiful promises, no substantive negotiations have taken place in this direction. This is one of the most developed countries in the world. And this kind of stuff is still going on. I mean, similar actions took place in Spain, Portugal, Belgium, Germany, Switzerland, and the UK. And it was in the UK on March 13th, just to jump forward in time a little bit, where London cops would brutally suppress a vigil for Sarah Everard, who herself, you know, 33-year-old, who was abducted and murdered by a police officer, by a serving police officer earlier this month. And the cops tried to suppress, silence those speaking out in her memory. You know, disgusting display of violence there on Clapham Common in London. I mean, as one of the participants in the rally said, quote, you know, the irony of it is so explicit. Are you going to drag women off the street for protesting about a woman being dragged off the street? And in a follow-up protest at Parliament Square the next day, so I mean, basically, so on Sunday, on the 14th, the names of, there was a big protest against the police brutality on the 13th. And in that protest, the names of women killed by their partners or have died in UK prisons were read out. And once again, I mean, the UK is, you know, Western European country, but like still epidemic of violence against women especially since the pandemic broke out. And in this case, we have a cop, you know, kidnapping and murdering a woman off the street But I want to return to India, a country that really should be in the news more often given what's been happening there over the last few months. And of course, I've dedicated a show to that at the end of January. You know, I've talked and I talked about the farmers' strike that has been going on there since last December and how millions of Indian workers have struck in solidarity with the farmers. You know, facing the far-right government of Prime Minister Modi with its biggest challenge in years. But attention must be paid to the crucial role that women have played in all of this. I mean, right from the beginning, they have played a key organizing role in the farmers' movement against the government's neoliberal agricultural laws. And it has been a life-changing experience for many of them. And that's really what I want to focus on here. I mean, you know, a lot of these women were never politically organized before. Now they are. And they're coming out en masse and participating in this and really becoming a driving force in these protests. And many thousands of women gathered at the Tikri and Singhu, these two like regional centers outside New Delhi, you know, the capital of India, on March 8th in a Women's Day demonstration that was really epic in every way. Not just in size either. You know, of course, in the size, you know, tens of thousands, basically. Like, maybe hundreds of thousands showed up for this. But it included everyone from teenagers to 80-year-old elders. And they came from all over, even from, like, remote parts of Haryana and Punjab, organized by the All India Democratic Women Association and the Center of Indian Trade Unions and other groups. One of the women farmers, Sheila Bhutana, who came to the demonstration along with 50 other women from her home village. She condemned the farm laws that were condemning her family to financial ruin. But she also highlighted the empowerment that this movement has given to women. And she said, quote, "There is no doubt that the movement provided equal opportunities to women. But the real battle remains to be fought in families and farms where we are still less valued in comparison with men, although our hard labor remains the same." End quote. And Jagmati Sangwan of the All India Democratic Women Association told the progressive Indian news organization NewsClick, which some of you might have heard in recent years, was, you know, like raided by the cops and basically like... you know, like persecuted basically for like covering, for being one of the few news outlets that would actually cover these protests right from the beginning and recovering them from the beginning and interviewing organizers and interviewing like women like this. But yeah, Jagmati Sangwan told NewsClick that, quote, "The fact of the matter is women have only 13% of land entitlements, whereas they contribute 70% of farming labor. It has simply deprived us from nearly all welfare schemes, be it compensation for damage of crops or any relief if a female farmer dies by suicide due to agrarian distress. Women are suffering at every front." I mean, in India, 71% of women in rural areas are engaged in agriculture, compared with 53% of men. But 83% of agricultural land is inherited by male family members. And female farmers lack access to even basic loans and infrastructure due to the patriarchal nature of the system. But Sangwan, you know, she praised the farmers' movement for recognizing the role of women in the struggle and that the value of their labor and access to land must be made equal to that of men. You know, this is something that the movement has recognized, the farmers' movement has recognized. And, in reference to the deep chauvinism and impunity that has characterized India under the current Modi government, in which, of course, is, you know, far-right, basically fascist kind of government that basically really does not respect, doesn't even pretend to respect, like, any you know, women's rights. Let alone women who are, like, you know, not Hindu or of, like, a lower caste of Hindu... Hindu society, like a Dalit or any of these kind of people, you know, just total repression of women, total impunity for violence against women. But in reference to this, one of the women who was speaking at the rally said, Quote, "My dear sisters, the struggle is not just limited to these farm laws alone. Please reject all of Manuwadi theories, which have so far limited your identity to childbearing mothers." And I think by Manuwadi theories, she means like these kind of right-wing, you know, basically proto-fascist theories, which like the ruling, the government is of the BJP, you know, this Hindutva, basically like Hindu supremacist party has been spreading around and popularizing. You know, reject those theories, which confine your identity to that of childbearing mothers. You know, you can do so much more than that. You know, and it's it was noteworthy that the stages at these rallies were guarded by exclusively women guards. I mean, and this highlights the reality that India is among the most violent places for women in the world. And this is actually required. I mean, even before Modi was actually in power, this was the case. He just made the situation, a bad situation, worse. And this has actually required women to band together for self-defense. I mean, you might have heard like groups like the Pink Sari gang and stuff like, and groups like that who actually go around and physically, you know, protect women against abusive husbands, right? You know, that's the kind of thing that women need to do in a place like this because it's so violent. You know, so much violence against women. But many speakers of the rally, they announced their resolve to struggle, to quote, struggle for the right to equality in society and to strive to fight against oppression and discrimination women have been subjected to. And it's just this self-confidence that the farmers' movement has given to many Indian rural women. Like, this was captured in the words of one woman who arrived at the rally by tractor from Haryana. And she said, quote, "This is women's power. This is women's power. It makes me believe that I can do anything. Long live women's unity." And by the way, that was the chant, you know, throughout these rallies, you know, long live women's unity. That's what they were saying. That was just the chant, the spirit. But this woman, yeah, like she says, okay, being here, like this is women's power. It, you know, and she believes that she can do anything. You know, like that's the kind of empowerment that she's feeling going to this rally. You know, despite of all the oppression that she's faced in her life, you know, she goes to this rally, you know, because part of this movement, and it's like, I can do anything. You know, she feels this like just empowerment. You know, and these defiant words like these, this confidence, it really reminds me of what the women of Petrograd must have felt on March 8th, 1917, when they walked off the job in the city's textile mills in the Vyborg district, initially to protest against the food shortages and high price of bread that was the result of World War I. But they soon began chanting, "Down with the war and down with the monarchy." You know, and then the strike spread and drew in tens of thousands of Russian workers and soldiers. And 8 days later, the Tsar abdicated. Like, women were in the vanguard of the Russian Revolution. Socialist women, you know, including many who were members of Lenin's Bolshevik Party. You know, they played an important part locally and nationally, every level. They distributed agitation leaflets, agitated among peasant women. They continued to spearhead strikes and demonstrations. Bolshevik Vera Slutskaya, you know, she led the establishment of a party bureau dedicated to organizing women, and also revived Robotnitsa, which is the woman worker, which is a major Bolshevik publication. And that encouraged women to demand more, you know, to participate in their local Soviets, you know, the workers' councils, and to join their fellow workers on strike. And they did. Like, in March 1917, laundry workers led by the Bolshevik Sofia Gonchartskaya, you know, they struck for weeks for better conditions. And in April, 100,000 soldiers' wives demanded better rations and an end to the war, which the provisional government, which came in after the Tsar, was continuing the war. And, like, they were saying, like, no, we want peace now. And that August, later in that year, 1917, you know, Bolshevik women organized armed self-defense. you know, like of Petrograd. Red Sisters, the Red Sisters provided medical assistance and built barricades in Petrograd during General Kornilov's reactionary coup attempt. And they were fundamental in holding that coup attempt back and defeating it. Women in the Red Guards laid down their lives in defense of the revolution. And like I said before, Bolsheviks played a role both locally and nationally. They spoke at public meetings. They distributed leaflets. They were transporting weapons and using weapons if they were in the Red Guards. Guaranteeing communications and providing care for the wounded. You know, they were just involved in everything. You know, and in July 1917, women over the age of 20 were finally given the right to vote and hold public office. Although it wouldn't be until November 1917, in the wake of the October Revolution and the Bolshevik seizure of power, that women really got the first opportunity to use that right, and they did. You know, I mean, they voted en masse in some areas, like Yaroslavl. Yeah, I mean, women's turnout outnumbered that of men, you know, as they went out and voted for the first time. You know, amidst this revolution, they were so much a part of making happen, making possible. I mean, when socialist revolution comes to India, as it did to Russia, women will most certainly be at the forefront. And the same applies to other countries where patriarchal violence reinforces capitalism and facilitates the double oppression that women face, which is reinforced still further in many parts of the world by structures of racism, empire, and colonialism. There can be no revolution without women, and that includes queer women and trans women too. And I want to end by once again quoting, I did this last year, but it's worth doing again. I want to quote the following excerpt from Alexandra Kollontai's 1920 article, International Women's Day. Of course, Alexandra Kollontai was one of the leading Bolshevik women in the Russian Revolution. Women's Day, or Working Women's Day, is a day of international solidarity and a day for reviewing the strength and organization of proletarian women. But this is not a special day for women alone. The 8th of March is a historic and memorable day for the workers and peasants, for all the Russian workers, and for the workers of the whole world. In 1917, on this day, the great February Revolution broke out. It was the working women of Petersburg who began this revolution. It was they who first decided to raise the banner of opposition to the Tsar and his associates. And so Working Women's Day is a double celebration for us. Women's Day turned out, above all, to be an excellent method of agitation among the less political of our proletarian sisters. They could not help but turn their attention to the meetings, demonstrations, posters, pamphlets, and newspapers that were devoted to Women's Day. Even the politically backward working women thought to herself, "This is our day, the festival for working women," and she hurried to the meetings and demonstrations. After each Working Women's Day, more women joined the socialist parties and the trade unions grew. Organizations improved and political consciousness developed. These are the results of Working Women's Day of militancy. The Day of Working Women's Militancy helps increase the consciousness and organization of proletarian women. And this means that its contribution is essential to the success of those fighting for a better future for the working class. Working Women's Day was first organized 10 years ago in the campaign for the political equality of women and the struggle for socialism. This aim has been achieved by working class women in Russia. In the Soviet Republic, the working women and peasants don't need to fight for the franchise and for civil rights. But rights alone are not enough. We have to learn to make use of them. The right to vote is a weapon which we have to learn to master for our own benefit and for the good of the workers. for the good of the Workers' Republic. In the 2 years of Soviet power, life itself has not been absolutely changed. We are only in the process of struggling for communism, and we are surrounded by the world we have inherited from the dark and repressive past. Working women and peasant women can only rid themselves of this situation and achieve equality in life itself, and not just in law, if they put all their energies into making Russia a truly communist society. After the experience of the Russian October Revolution, it is clear to every working woman in France, in England, and in other countries that only the dictatorship of the working class, only the power of the Soviets can guarantee complete and absolute equality. The ultimate victory of communism will tear down the century-old chains of repression and lack of rights. Only the overthrow of capitalism and the establishment of Soviet power will save them from the world of suffering, humiliations, and inequality that makes the life of the working woman in the capitalist countries so hard. The working woman's day turns from a day of struggle for the franchise into an international day of struggle for the full and absolute liberation of women, which means a struggle for the victory of the Soviets and for communism.
We'll be right back.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that was Lillian Allen with I Fight Back. And before that, we had, of course, Pat Benatar with Invincible, which I just thought that was a song that really captured some of the spirit, at least, of what Alexandra Kollontai was saying in that piece on International Women's Day, which I quoted there in the last segment, which was a very long one. You know, I apologize. That was a lot of talking on my part. But I felt that it was just necessary. I mean, so much is going on in the world that just does not get talked about or doesn't get talked about in such a way that connections are made internationally. And of course, on this show, we're all about internationalism. You know, like, we want to make those connections, understand how people can unite across borders, how working class people and oppressed people around the world can unite, form a common front, and fight against the common enemies that they face in the form of, like, capitalism, imperialism, and basically all these forces which are keeping them down, keeping them oppressed, and of course keeping women doubly oppressed, racialized women even more oppressed, right? All these degrees of oppression that basically everybody faces within capitalism. You know, like, if you're not a member of the owning class, you're going to face some sort of oppression. But, you know, our ability to unite is constantly being compromised by the fact, like, of how the system, like, works to divide us, right? So this is that's one of the reasons why, like, I just wanted to do that whole, like, tour around the world. And of course, I was by no means exhaustive. I mean, like, there's a lot of areas I didn't cover, but, you know, just emphasizing what is going on, like, just with the women's struggles and stuff. And obviously, I'm, as a man, I have a lot to learn about this kind of stuff. Like, I am by no means an expert. You know, I put the time in, I do the best I can, but there's always room for improvement. There's always ways that I have to criticize myself and engage myself, catch myself thinking in certain ways that I need to, like, you know, push back on. And this kind of stuff. And that of course is like what a lot of men who are part of the working class have to do. They want to stand in solidarity with women and genuinely fight alongside women to achieve to see liberation for women and ultimately for the working class as a whole. There needs to be that purging of patriarchal attitudes and ideas, which in many cases are deep-seated, not challenged, taken for granted. I mean, if you want to see how this works, I mean, look at fairy tales, right? There is so much inside a fairy tale. These are the things we grow up with. I mean, how many of these fairy tales, you look at them, and I've been doing a course on children's literature recently, so I've kind of had a chance to look at these things on a deeper level. And it's like, yeah, you look at half of these like fairy tales, it's like the misogyny that is in there, you know, the oppression of women that is just baked into the core of these tales. And so much is just taken for granted. You know, the ideology is baked in so much, it's not even really addressed. It's just taken for granted. Okay, the woman must obey her father or like willingly surrender herself and all her interests to like her prospective husband or like whatever else. Just, you know, taken patriarchal authority is just taken for granted in these stories. And that's when things are taken for granted. That's when an ideology is the most dangerous, when it's the most pervasive, when it's the most does the most because it's hidden. It's just accepted. It's not challenged. And that's what makes it so invasive and so insidious. Like a lot of patriarchal attitudes are not challenged. They're just in there. You know, they're just, they're baked in hard in how we learn and how we get brought up. And it takes a lot of effort to push back against that, to purge that, to get to a place where you actually can listen to women. Like really listen to them. And what they go through in their struggles and all this. And really, like, be an ally, really stand with them. There is so much you have to unlearn. And it's a long process that is very difficult for a lot of men. But it's something they have to keep doing, keep trying, keep striving. If you want to get to a place where women's dignity and ultimately human dignity is for real, you know, like it's really respected. It's really concrete. It's not just in words. But it's in the communities, it's in our guts, it's in like everything we do. And then we can really put behind this horrific legacy of violence that you know, where 90% of those women who reported being victimized were victimized by an intimate partner. By a man. You know, like they're supposed to have a loving relationship with, but like, you know, this is where the violence happens the majority of times, vast majority of cases. So what I want to do to round out the show, I want to kind of pay tribute to somebody who really deserves more attention than she gets. This is, of course, Leslie Feinberg, you know, a queer communist, lesbian communist who was with the Workers' World Party in the United States and who just played such a major role in the queer liberation movement and was a communist like throughout like her career, working class, you know, wrote a number of like many amazing works on the struggles of queer people within socialist movements, you know, as well as the Stone Butch Blues, which is like probably the work that she's most well known for. But a lot more besides that, you know, like, and I would urge you all, if you haven't already, to really check her out and her work. But she passed away in 2014. And this was actually, this next segment I want to do is a, just to round the show up, this is the conclusion, is a tribute that her comrades, that a woman comrade in the Workers' World Party made to her. And about her life, just kind of speaking about her life and the impact that she had. And that's kind of how I want to round out here women's, this belated International Women's Day episode back in the USSR. So I want to round things out. So please stay tuned. And I will see you next time. Solidarity, comrades and friends.
coming after Bill's talk, I really want to start with the first demonstration that Leslie came to. It was in 1973. It was the October War. How do you explain the October War? The Yom Kippur.
Egypt, Syria, trying to take back occupied land.
The land that Israel had occupied in the 67 war. And you can imagine the, you know, virulent anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab climate. The party in Buffalo, the branch in Buffalo, organized a demonstration outside a Zionist event that was happening at the big hall where the Buffalo Symphony is. And we came with what we called our combat boots, and we were, you know, organized in squads, and we were ready for what I don't think turned out to be a big fight, but really we were ready for it. Leslie, that was the first demonstration that Leslie came to, a Jewish trans worker in Buffalo. She heard about this demonstration from her coworker Molly, and Leslie came to this demonstration and found her home in Workers' World Party. We lost Leslie last Saturday after a long illness. Leslie now was so well known, respected, and loved in the LGBTQ communities. There has been an outpouring of moving messages, especially some of the reading messages on Facebook of countless people whose lives were influenced by Leslie. And there have been lots of obituaries. I mean, I think I only knew a few of them from The Advocate, the longtime gay magazine, The Guardian in England, The Buffalo Evening News, The Atlantic, a very moving piece, Fight Back News, and I'm sure it goes on and on. Workers' World newspaper had the extensive full-page article written by Leslie's spouse, Minnie Bruce Pratt, up online all week. And it's in the printed edition of the paper now for everyone to read. And the party will be scheduling a memorial sometime in the future, you know, whenever we figure is the best time, when we can really go over Leslie's life and enormous contributions to the party, to the LGBT struggle, especially the trans struggle, and the revolutionary struggle, really. So 1973 was when Leslie joined the party, and she came to New York a year later in 1974 and worked on every mobilization and campaign of the party, starting with the Boston March Against Racism, where she went to Boston to organize. And you can read a lot about all the different, you know, in Minnie Bruce's article, you can read a lot about Leslie's history. Leslie began learning to write for Workers' World newspaper when she came to New York, and was the editor of the political prisoner page, for 15 years, and eventually became a managing editor of Workers' World, which she continued really for the rest of her life. Only her severe illness prevented in recent years. In the 70s and the 80s, Leslie began researching through history for the history. For someone who works on sound, I don't know how to do this. Leslie began researching, extensive research, for the history of trans people. And she found an enormous amount. and with the encouragement of founding comrade Dottie Ballin, Leslie began to apply Marxism to understand the oppression of trans people and the road to liberation. In 1992, the party published Leslie's groundbreaking pamphlet, Transgender Liberation, of Movement Whose Time Has Come. Right. That was the same time also that Leslie wrote the novel Stone Butch Blues, which she was able to get published the next year. It's based on her experiences of her life in the factories and gay bars of Buffalo and Western New York in the 60s before Stonewall. The novel expressed in a way that really hadn't been done before the experience as a butch lesbian, as a gender non-conforming person, and it just touched a chord. It just really, people, you hear in the messages that people are putting out in the obituaries, how this book changed people's lives in giving an understanding of themselves that was powerful. The book sold hundreds of thousands of copies, was translated into 7 languages. It's been out of print for years now. And Leslie, right up until the last week of her life, was working on a 20th anniversary free version of it. Her book, Transgender Warriors, From Joan of Arc to Dennis Rodman, was published in 1996 and was able to incorporate a really lot of the research that Leslie had done, and it had a huge impact on the growing trans movement. And Leslie had a big impact on the growing trans movement at that time. It was really a time when the T was being added to LGBT. It was really when the trans movement was coming forward. And Leslie in that book had a huge impact, and her writings are used in colleges and academia, you know, wherever, any kind of studying across this country and internationally. It's hard to explain, if you haven't seen it, how widely known and loved Leslie was. She was really an icon. Leslie was asked to speak and participate, I should say, too, especially among young people, and a few LGBTQ young people and young people in general, and among a few generations. It's been, you know, a number of years. And Leslie was asked to speak and participate in events all over, up until her health made it not possible. The thing is that when Leslie spoke, she brought all the party's politics skillfully and winningly. And I really think that's what people loved. She brought forward the struggle of trans people. And she also always talked about solidarity. She talked about fighting racism and really the national question and self-determination, anti-imperialism, and the class struggle. And Leslie was always clear that she saw socialism as a road to liberation. Minnie Bruce says in the beautiful obituary in Workers' World that Leslie's last words were, "Hasten the revolution. Remember me as a revolutionary communist." Well, that is a message to her comrades, to us in the party, to hasten the revolution. Leslie Feinberg, presente.